earth, fire, air, water. Long ago, in the early days of the Chun Tai era, Avatar Korra helped the nations of our world find a new balance among themselves. The world of Dicho entered a peaceful age of invention and discovery. But then everything changed again when we discovered the world beyond the veil. Now, 70 years later, we enter a new galactic age, and it has become the Avatar's new duty to seek balance between her homeworld and the universe beyond. Friday, June 14th, 2391. New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. A sunny afternoon in the last week of spring, and business was proceeding as usual at Ryan Matthews Memorial Spaceport in New Avalon. In the small customs and immigration office off the freight terminal, Officer Mike Zant had just finished in-processing the crew of a freighter newly arrived from Zipang out in the Enigma sector. An easy job. 6 very polite young spacers with all their papers in order. Zipangi crews very rarely gave C&I any sort of problem, and these 6 had been no exception. They seemed in high spirits about something. As they left for an evening's liberty in town, they chattered among themselves about how some recent event, Zant wasn't sure what, was sure to bring them all good fortune. He sat back at his console and checked how much longer his shift had to run. 3 hours, and no more ships scheduled to arrive in that time, so he might just be able to make some progress on his math homework. Humming a bit to himself, the Zipangi spacer's good cheer was catching, he got out his textbook and notes and turned his attention to making sense of first-order transcendentals. A few moments later, though, the door leading out to the terminal side opened again, and another person entered. She was a young woman, apparently human, with her dark hair drawn up into a high, almost topknot-like ponytail, and a pair of sidelocks whose tips brushed her collarbones. As she entered the office, she looked around with the universal expression of a person who is not entirely sure this is the right room, giving Zant time to get a good look at her. This he most assuredly wanted, because she was exceptionally good-looking, with a strikingly pretty face and medium brown skin that made a pleasing contrast with her clothing's palette of blues and grays. The first thing about that clothing that caught the young customs officer's eye was the upper half, a tight-fitting blue singlet top, mandarin-collared but sleeveless, presenting a toned and well-proportioned upper body that was, Zant thought, well worth showing off. That was revealed by the fact that she had the upper half of her baggy steel-gray jumpsuit tied jauntily around her waist, making a sort of half-cape of it. Completing her sweep of the room, she spotted Zant at his desk and smiled, showing very white teeth, then hitched her small blue duffel bag higher on one shoulder and strode across the office toward him. She moved like the athlete she obviously was, smoothly and confidently, without a lot of pointless adornment. Her curious, soft boots, which looked to Zant more like something a person would wear in winter, rendered her steps almost silent, despite the customs office's echoey tile floor. "Hi," she said when she arrived at Zant's high desk. "Customs, right? I just came in on the Omoshiro Maru." She zipped open a little pocket on the side of her bag and fished out a red-covered Zipangi passport, which she placed on the counter in front of him. Zant smiled. He liked her voice as much as the rest of her so far, and picked up the document, first slotting it into the reader on his console so that it could interrogate the data web built into the cover, then opening it to carry out the required, anachronistic but satisfying personal inspection. Yep, there she was, smiling cheerfully out of the holograph next to the usual machine-printed block of personal information. Mizuzoku Korra, Zipangi National, born April 14th, 2372. 5'7", 142 pounds. He could believe that. She was a sturdy-looking gal, not one of those off-putting muscles-on-muscles types, but very nicely cut. Eyes, an amazing shade of blue, hair brown, skin brown, species human, primary descent Earth. On the console window, the reader's data scrolled past, matching the physical documents. After that came the results of a quick background check. No criminal record, no wants or warrants, immigration status clear, Scion status null, no known danger to public safety, health, or order. Officer Zant was to consider her perfectly fit, ha, for admittance to the Republic of Zeta Cygni, and have a nice day. With a warm, no-worries smile that was a little more sincere than was sometimes the case, Zant told her, "Everything appears to be in order, Mizuzoku-san. Just a couple of quick questions for our records, all right? What's your purpose in visiting Zeta Cygni?" "Oh, just looking around," she replied with an eloquent shrug, "hoping to see new sights and meet new people." Zant's official smile became a bit of a grin. "Gap year, huh?" he said. She was the right age, only a couple of years his junior, and they did get specimens like her through here sometimes. Fresh-faced kids going by freighter to save credits and or have an experience, traveling light and hoping to see the universe before returning home to start college. He rather wished he could have done something like that himself, but as it was, he'd had to go straight to work and see to continuing his studies and his time off. "Something like that," she replied, grinning in turn. "About how long will you be staying?" "I'm not sure," she said. "Maybe 2 or 3 weeks. Depends on where the wind takes me." Zant gave a knowing nod. "Well, that shouldn't be an issue, then. For citizens of other Federation members, no visas are required for stays of up to 3 months. If for some reason you find you'll be staying longer than that, just check in with your embassy. I doubt you'll have any problems as long as you stay out of trouble," he added cheerfully. "Ha ha, right," she said, nodding agreeably. "Do you have any fruit, meat products, weapons of any kind?" Kora shook her head and started to say no, then caught herself, zipped open her bag, and rummaged inside it for a second, coming up with a small pouch of what looked like some kind of oiled and polished leather. "I do have some seal jerky," she said apologetically. "Nearly forgot about it." She opened the pouch and showed him its contents, which did indeed appear to be a quantity of dried meat. "That smells really good," said Zant before he could stop himself. Then, faintly abashed, he added, "Sorry, I skipped lunch." "Well, if you have to confiscate it anyway, you can have it," said Kora with a friendly smile. "Only, do you have something to put it in? I want to keep the pouch. I've had it a long time." Zant returned the smile. He'd found this young woman physically attractive at first sight, but now he found he was really starting to like her personality as well. "No, that's okay," he said. "Looks like there's less than 8 ounces there. You can keep it." With a wry grin, he added, "I doubt you're importing it with the intent to engage in commercial resale." Kora laughed. "No, not so much," she agreed. "You can have some anyway if you want." Zant shook his head. "I'd love to, but it's not allowed. We can't accept gifts from people we're in or out processing, be it food or otherwise." "Yeah, I guess that makes sense," she said, nodding. "Makes me feel kind of mean, though, waving it in your face when you hadn't had lunch." She closed the pouch and stowed it away. "Well," he said, "I did ask." "True," she said. "Anyway, no fruit, no weapons." "Good, good," said Zant with a nod. He scrolled through a couple more screens, admitted to himself that he was just looking for excuses to keep her here a little longer, and keyed in her entry permission, then closed the session and returned her passport with a smile. "You're all set, Mizuzoku-san. Welcome to New Avalon. I hope you enjoy your visit." Then, hazarding as much of a personal remark as his professional ethics would allow him, he added, "And that I'm on duty when you leave." Kora grinned and put her passport back in its pocket. "Why, thank you, Officer Zant," she said, reading his name tag. "That's very sweet." Spying his homework spread out on his desk behind the counter, she leaned for a closer look. What you working on? Looks like trig. Transcendentals in general, he replied, then explained, I'm in night school. Oh yeah, what for? She asked, sounding genuinely interested. Civil engineering, Zant said. Cool, said Cora. That's a good field. More exciting than working the customs desk. She winked, her grin becoming slightly wicked, and added, although you won't meet as many girls. Zant coughed, reddening. well. Ha! I'm just kidding with you, she said, reaching across the counter to tag his shoulder. You've been a real gentleman. Hey, maybe I'll see you around sometime. Enjoy the rest of your day. And like a storm blowing out to sea, she was gone, leaving Mike Zant red-faced, smiling a little goofily, and grateful that nobody else was likely to pass through his domain this afternoon. I have a message from another time. Avery Productions Unlimited and Magnetic Terrapin Studios present Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Legacy of Korra, Book 6, Galaxy, Chapter 1, An Avatar in New Avalon, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, that's me, and Philip Jeremy Moyer. Korra, actually Korra, but the Zipangi Department of State couldn't put a macron on a consonant, emerged from the freight terminal's public side and stood for a few minutes by the side of the access road, just looking out and up at the New Avalon skyline. She'd seen pictures of the place before coming, but they couldn't compare with really seeing it. She was no stranger to big cities. She'd lived for many years now in, or at least near, what she held to be her homeworld's greatest metropolis, bustling, skyscraper-rich Republic City. New Avalon was bigger. On any scale she cared to name, the tallest building in Republic City at present stood a very respectable 105 stories. Here in New Avalon, they had towers that loomed four times that high, reaching more than a mile into the clear blue sky, and not one or two, but at least a dozen, plus a multitude of lesser buildings that themselves would have dwarfed anything back home. And it covered so much more ground. It was still possible, just, to get all of Republic City into a wide-angle photograph without having to be so far back that the buildings were indistinguishable one from another. From this vantage point, on a peninsula jutting out into Lake Daniels at the north end of the city's water frontage, New Avalon sprawled from horizon to horizon, the towers getting lower as one moved away from the obvious center point, but never petering out into suburbs or hinterland within the observer's field of view. It was all the more staggering when she considered that, a mere 10 years before, this place had been nothing more than some grassy hills on a lake shore. "Gonna take me a few days to get my bearings in this place," she remarked to herself, then headed for the nearby subway station, pleasingly marked with a giant block capital chrome N. Korra went downtown and found a bookstore and a decent but not exorbitantly pricey hotel in that order, installed herself in a corner room on a high floor, and spread maps and guidebooks on the bed. The first day was spent, apart from an excursion down the block to a place that sold a strange and wondrous noodle dish, recommended by the friendly, blue-faced gent at the front desk, devising a strategy. The city was obviously too vast to tackle as anything like a single comprehensive project. She would have to break it up into smaller pieces and take them one at a time, then try to synthesize an overall impression at the end. With that in mind, she took a grease pencil and marked the laminated street map she'd bought in a slightly haphazard grid, more or less along the edges of the differently colored sections intended to denote boroughs and neighborhoods, then numbered them as if she intended to conduct a search. Grid section 1, in the upper right corner of the map, encompassed the waterfront districts of Docklands and Puckett's Landing. The former looked to be little more than the wharves and warehouses of the city's main freight terminal, which was not likely to be that touristy. But Puckett's Landing did have one intriguing feature, a sports facility marked with the legend Knight's Field. With a smile, Cora decided that the first thing she would do would be to take in a baseball game. Saturday, June 15th. The first thing that struck Cora about the New Avalon Knights was that their tickets were very reasonably priced. The second was that they had a charming, if rather small, ballpark, full of appealing old-fashioned touches and cleverly designed to fit in its peculiarly shaped lot. And the third, which might have been related to the first, was that they were terrible. Baseball wasn't a native sport on her homeworld. It was a fairly recent import from Zipang, where, by then, the locals had already skewed it somewhat in the century and a half since the planet was settled. That said, she had a pretty reasonable understanding of the basics, having been one of the earliest proponents of the sport's adoption in Dicho. Even if she hadn't understood the plays themselves, though, it would have been obvious just from the score that the Knights were hopelessly outclassed by their visiting opponents. Oddly enough, though, nobody in the stands appeared to mind much. The crowd, which she estimated at around 30,000 people, were almost all supporters of the home team, to judge from their hats and whatnot, and they all seemed quite happy with their lot as they sat and watched that team get thumped 12-2 by the Mega Tokyo Giants. Part of that might simply have been that it was such a nice day, Cora decided, and the ballpark's incredible hot dogs probably had something to do with it too. After the game, as she was making her way out of the park, and marveling at the evidently undampened good cheer of the team's fan base, she noticed the uniformed police officers standing here and there around the place, near the turnstiles and doorways, mostly. They didn't seem to be doing much of anything, just kind of standing around showing the flag. As Cora stood by one of the pretzel stands on the concourse behind the main grandstand and watched, a couple of them interacted with members of the public, providing directions and the like, always with a sort of casual goodwill that went well with the overall vibe of the city as she had so far experienced it. While she watched, she considered the equivalent of this scene back home. Republic City cops, as a general rule, were no longer so naturally disposed to dabble in jackbooted thuggery as they had once been, but in Cora's experience, they did not smile at members of the public. Particularly not in a crowd control scenario, like letting out time at Shiro Shinobi Arena. Picture Lin Beifong ruffling some kid's hair and making sure he doesn't lose his foam We're Number One hand, she thought, and the mental image made her giggle as she made to leave the ballpark herself, now that the crowd at the exit had thinned a bit. As she turned, she saw another uniformed figure at the end of the row of turnstiles. At the sight of this one, she pulled up short, blinking in momentary disbelief, then walked slowly over for a closer look. Standing next to the big one-way revolving gate through which a lot of people were leaving, there was a bear. A polar bear, white-furred and massive, a good 6 feet tall at the shoulder, dressed in what was essentially the regular New Avalon police uniform, as adapted for a bear. He even, Cora noticed, had a necktie and a badge. He was all bear, a configuration as mythical in Dicho as the more familiar polar bear dogs of her homeworld were out here, but familiar enough to bring an automatic grin to Cora's face as she approached him. Knights fans filed past him and through the gate. Some, particularly the children, took notice of him, but no one seemed to think it was at all strange that a polar bear in a police uniform was standing next to the exit, watching them leave. Presently, the bear appeared to notice that he was being scrutinized more closely than usual. Turning his attention from the passing sports fans, he regarded Cora with an expression that almost seemed to say, "Yes." "Wow," said Cora aloud. "They use bears for policing here?" She grinned. "There might be more going on in this town than I thought." Then, looking thoughtfully around, she mused, "Where's your handler got off to, big guy?" The bear arched a brow ridge and replied, "I beg your pardon." Cora stared at him, her eyes going wide. She resisted an urge to rub them theatrically and said, "Did you say something?" "Yes," the bear replied, becoming still more quizzical. He had a voice that went well with the rest of him, deep and rich, fully appropriate to have emanated from such a massive chest.
"You can talk," said Cora.
"Of course I can talk. I'm Minister for Overseas Development," the bear deadpanned. After hanging fire on startled disbelief for another second, Cora's face broke into an expression of utter delight.
"Hi! Sorry, it's kind of a long story. I'm not from around here. I thought you were..."
"An animal?" the bear inquired without rancor. Cora blushed and glanced away, abashed.
"Well, yeah, sorry," she repeated.
Then, her grin returning, she said,
"I'm Cora."
The bear inclined his head. "Nice to meet you, Cora. I'm Officer Ragnarsson. First time in New Avalon?"
"Second day in New Avalon," said Cora, a little sheepishly. "Still getting used to things. Listen, I'm really sorry about..."
"Don't worry about it," said Ragnarsson, lifting one of his massive forepaws from the ground in a dismissive gesture. "Did you enjoy the game?"
"Not really, but I enjoyed everybody else enjoying it, if you follow me," said Cora.
Ragnarsson chuckled. "That's probably the best the Knights are going to do with a first-timer from out of town," he conceded.
"Well, I'll let you get back to work," said Cora. "It was great meeting you, officer."
"Work," Ragnarsson replied, amused. "It's not exactly the front lines of the fight for justice out here. Still, it's 4 hours of overtime and a free ticket to the game. A bear can't complain about that." The corner of his mouth quirked in an unmistakable little grin. "Enjoy the rest of your stay in New Avalon, Cora. Maybe I'll see you around." It turned out that he would, and sooner than either of them probably thought. Rather than taking the inn back downtown to her hotel, she decided to walk. It was a nice day, she liked walking, and besides, she wanted to see the city anyway, so why not? South of Knight's Field, the warehouses and apartment blocks gave way to a shops and restaurants retail district, and Cora lingered there for the tail end of the afternoon, window shopping and watching the street scenes go by. It was there that she got her first inkling that not everything in New Avalon was cheerful baseball teams, cool bear cops, and Art Deco utopianism. That there was actual crime here, like in any big city. At the corner of one block of shops, she spotted a scene unfolding midway along on the other side of the street that was eerily familiar. Three oddly, fancily dressed people facing off against a plainly terrified shopkeeper in a textbook gangland shakedown. Cora had once made a marked impression on a new city by barging headlong into the middle of just such a scene. But though she looked no older now than she had been then, she was older, and she liked to think wiser. She still winced a little inside at the knowledge, obvious in retrospect, that she'd ended up doing more harm to the block than the guys she'd clobbered would have if she'd left them alone. This time, instead of charging in and wrecking the joint, she faded back before they could spot her, considered her options, and then, with a smile, pulled the police call box on the corner. That job done, she stood by the newspaper vending machine next to it and watched the scene. If it looked like someone was going to get hurt before the cops showed up, she'd involve herself. But if not, this would be a good opportunity to check out their response time and get an idea of how they worked when they weren't just directing traffic after a ball game. Within a minute, she had her answers,
as two beat cops and a radio car converged on the area from three different directions. The bad guys tried to make a run for it, but one of them made the mistake of picking a line of retreat that took him straight past one of the arriving officers, while the second, a woman, simply failed to outrun the car. That left the third, who was a swift young man with the lean build of a runner. He was a little cannier than his fellows, too, and instead of making a straight run for it up the sidewalk, he darted across the street, aiming for the alley a dozen yards or so from where Cora stood. One of the beat cops, attracted by the alarm, was hot on his heels, and to Cora's delight, it was Ragnarsson, unless the department had more than one polar bear officer. But the runner was clearly going to outdistance him into that alley. Or at least he would have, if the curb on the other side of the street hadn't been about 3 inches higher than he was expecting it to be when he got there. Tripping spectacularly, he went ass over tea kettle across the sidewalk and slammed headlong into a freestanding mail drop box, which rang with a hollow whong. By the time he recovered even half of his scattered wits, Ragnarsson had him cuffed and laid out face down on the sidewalk and was advising him of his rights. The other beat cop, who had corralled the men who'd tried to run past him, finished packing his quarry into the back of the radio car next to the gal, then trotted over to the call box. He was a tall, freckled young man with flaming red hair, his face flushed almost to match it from his exertions, and he was puffing slightly as he jogged to a halt and said, "Did you pull the box, miss?" Cora nodded. "Sure did. Figured those kids were pretty clearly up to no good." Grinning wryly, she added, "Their reactions when you guys turned up didn't hurt my thesis any." The officer, Schweikart, according to the name tag above his badge, laughed. No, indeed, he said. "Nice work. I'm going to need to get a statement." "You again," Ragnarsson rumbled, sounding amused as he ambled up next to the red-headed cop. "I said enjoy your stay, not go out and fight some crime." Cora laughed. "Right place, right time," she said. "Least I could do, right?" "You guys know each other, Rags?" Schweikart asked. "She was at the Knights game this afternoon," said Ragnarsson. "We chatted a bit. Cora, right?" Cora nodded. "Yep." Schweikart got out a little notebook and clicked his pen. "How's that spelled?" Cora got out her passport, which was the only ID she had on her that was suitable for the occasion, and he took down her details, then made a note of where she was staying. "Okay, that should be all I need for right now," said Schweikart, putting away his notebook and pen. "We'll need you to swing by the 4th Precinct Station sometime in the next 48 hours to sign a certified copy of your statement, since you'll probably have left town by the time those clowns get in front of a judge." Cora nodded again. "I can do that," she said. "Well, thanks for your help, Mizuzoku-san," said Schweikart. "Hopefully the rest of your stay in town will be a little less eventful. Oh, and in case nobody else has said it yet..." He smiled. "Welcome to New Avalon." Sunday, June 16th. Cora rose early by her standards, meditated for half an hour, had a nice breakfast in the hotel's miniature cafe, then spent much of the morning with her guidebooks and maps, working some more on her plan, such as it was, for the week. She felt she was starting to get a reasonably good handle on just how big the city really was, and a feel for which bits of it were where, from studying both her nice laminated street map and a diagram of the subway system she'd picked up on her return from Puckett's Landing the day before. With that in mind, she had the beginning of a larger strategy starting to kick around in her head. At midday, she returned to the landing. Along the way, inspired by the cops the day before, She nipped into a corner drugstore and bought a small hardback notebook and a felt-tipped pen, the better to record her own impressions in the upcoming few days. With that done, she hunted around a bit until she found the 4th Precinct Police Station, a low brick building that was not out of place among the warehouses and whatnot of the neighborhood's north end. Schweikart was out, but he'd told the desk sergeant to expect her. She, in turn, had a typed copy of the statement Cora had given him the day before, waiting at the desk for her to review and sign. With a blank space on the back for her to write any new impressions or bits of information she might have recalled in the interim. She didn't have any, so she signed and returned it. As she was leaning on the counter and shooting the breeze with Sergeant Morris, Ragnarsson lumbered out of a side door and across the lobby. At the sight of her, he sloped toward the desk, smiling the same faintly sardonic little smile she'd seen on him the day before.
"You come around like a bad habit," he said mildly. "Here to sign your statement?"
"Just finished," Cora told him. "They tell me I missed Schweikart."
"He's 1067," said Ragnarsson with a nod. "If I know Russ, he'll be cursing his timing for days."
Cora raised an eyebrow. "1067?" she inquired.
"Lunch," said Ragnarsson and Morris together.
"Ah." Ragnarsson and Cora left the building together, he to begin walking his beat, she intending to go with him only as far as the end stop and head back downtown. As they ambled unhurriedly along the sidewalk, she said, "So, when I got back to my hotel room yesterday, the first thing I did was search on Talking Polar Bear."
"And did you enjoy The Amazing Adventures of Ingmar Ursanov?" Ragnarsson asked dryly.
Cora chuckled, because that movie was indeed the first item her web search had returned.
"It was okay," she said.
Ragnarsson nodded.
"It was either that," he said, "or an episode of Octonauts."
"That was second," Cora said with a grin. From there they entered into a discussion of polar regions and their connections to same. Cora came from below her homeworld's Antarctic Circle, while Ragnarsson hailed from the far north of ice planet Halloran V, a region so inhospitable that even the planet's hardy human settlers left it entirely to the genetically engineered bears who had helped them tame the planet's icy wildernesses. So involved were they in this that Cora forgot all about her plan to leave him at the subway station, and an hour later she realized that she had no idea where they were.
"I seem to have followed you into unknown territory," she admitted sheepishly.
The Ursine officer regarded her with a slightly skeptical eye.
"You aren't some kind of bear groupie, are you?" he wondered. "We get those from time to time."
As Cora gave him a puzzled look, he went on,
"If you are, let me just save you some time and tell you straight up. The internet lied about your chances."
"Huh?"
Cora blinked, then went red.
"Oh, no, 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 nothing like that. Back home, we have an animal called a polar bear dog, which is about what you'd expect from the name. I raised them, have since I was a kid. That's why I was so surprised when you talked to me."
She gave a sentimental little smile.
"I think on some level I've been wishing that would happen most of my life. But I'm not a, groupie," she added. "Honest. To each his or her own and all, but that's not for me."
Ragnarsson gave a seismic chuckle and half smiled, revealing one gleaming, saber-like upper canine. "Good," he said. "I'm starting to like you, and it would really mess up the feng shui if you went there."
Cora laughed. "Not going to be an issue," she said. "Promise."
"Good," the bear cop repeated. "In that case, maybe you'd better call me Ragnar."
"Your name is Ragnar Ragnarsson?"
"Mm-hmm," said Ragnar resignedly.
I know. Picture my parents.
Switching between a hilariously incongruous falsetto Russian accent and a voice that was even slightly deeper than his normal one, he went on,
Our cubby's boy, Ragnar. What shall we call him?
What about Ragnar?
Perfect!
Is it a family tradition thing? Cora wondered. I mean, if your father's also Ragnar Ragnarsson. Ragnar shook his head.
We don't do it that way. Dad's name is Ragnar Alfredsson.
Oh. Then I guess he was just stuck. They chattered on as they reached the southern edge of Ragnar's patrol area, then turned down one of the commercial streets to start making their way east. There were more people here. Most of the businesses were open, though it was early Sunday afternoon, and Cora noticed that Ragnar seemed to be a well-liked figure in the neighborhood. It wasn't in any way a surprise that people would recognize him, but that they would go out of their way to greet him spoke well for his reputation on the streets he patrolled. Children, in particular, would divert from their courses when they saw him and run by, often addressing him as Captain Barnacles as they did so.
How long have you been walking this beat? Cora wondered.
Bit more than a year, said Ragnar. It's my first posting. I'm still a rookie by NAPD standards.
Well, you seem to have made an impression, said Cora with a smile.
I make people feel safe, he said with a bearish shrug. Which is good. I mean, that's what we're supposed to do. At least the decent folks. One of these days I'd like to be known for more than just being big and strong, but I admit that's an uphill climb when you're a 1,500-pound bear, he added with a wry grin.
I don't know this town well enough to know what it takes in your department, Cora said. But back home, I'd say you need a case of your own. Something to get your superior's attention.
Ragnar nodded. Unfortunately, opportunities for same are a bit thin on the ground when you're on a foot posting in the landing. Ah, well, I'm just starting out. In a couple of years, I'll be able to apply for a transfer to one of the downtown precincts. Maybe pull a temporary detail or two with CID. One thing's for sure, though. I'm never going to make it as an undercover, he added with a wink.
They ate lunch, or what was lunch for Ragnar, who was on the 12 to 10 shift, after completing about 1.5 circuits of the day's patrol route, which brought them back to Clandon Street and the shops and restaurants there. At his prompting, Cora told him a little more about what she was in town for, omitting the bit about being on a fact-finding mission for a semi-transdimensional otherworld. He made a few recommendations for things a person trying to get to know New Avalon should check out in the first week, and cautioned her about a couple of parts of town where one ought to be a bit more wary than usual. They parted in a friendly way at the end stop nearest the restaurant, Cora with Ragnar's card, he with a slip of paper bearing the name of the hotel she was staying at, and vague plans to talk again once she'd seen some more of the city. Excerpt from Avatar Korra's Field Report to the White Lotus Advisory Council. Date: Sinti Tian, Liu Yue 16, 272 ASC. Section: Persons of Interest. Ragnarsson, Ragnar. Patrolman, New Avalon Police Department. Born January 12, 2367. Note: Yi Yue 12, 248 ASC. In Ovsyanikovgrad, Bear City, on Ice Planet Halloran 5, is, I am neither making this up nor drinking the special tea, a sapient polar bear. Huge, powerful, basically fearless, honest, trustworthy, and so forth. A real bear scout. Probably was a bear scout, now that I think about it. Dry sense of humor, stoical about discomfort, claims he gets that from his Russian mother. I'm not sure what that means. Strong protective instincts, which is why he became a cop in the first place. Protect the innocent, serve the public trust, uphold the law, in that order.
disdainful of rules derived from his bosses getting those priorities in the wrong order. As you might imagine, we get along just fine. Current assignment, foot patrol in the 4th Precinct, Puckett's Landing. Very popular with the public, the kind of cop all the kids on the playground run over to greet when he passes the school. Wishes to be known for more than just his brawn, but acknowledges that this is easier said than done for a giant bear. Note to Janora. If you're thinking, bear or not, this person doesn't sound particularly notable. Well, he's not, in and of himself. He's just a rookie cop. But I think he's a good indicator of the culture they have here, and he's my first contact in local law enforcement. And he's neat. So you guys get to read about him anyway. My field trip, my rules. Cora. Cora spent the week engrossed in research, roaming the city, absorbing local news and info, talking to people, and generally getting the lay of the land. She quickly settled into a pattern. In the mornings, after meditation and breakfast, she spent an hour or so with her guidebooks and maps, working out a game plan for the rest of the day. The first part of the plan was always getting to wherever Phase 2 was supposed to happen, which she made into part of the information-gathering process itself by walking whenever feasible and chatting with anyone who looked amenable to a conversation. By then it was usually lunchtime, after which she would spend the afternoon doing culture in some form or another, usually by visiting a museum of some kind. She had wondered initially whether there would be enough of them in the city for this to be worth doing. It was, after all, less than a decade old. But it turned out that the place was stuffed with them, not necessarily dealing with subjects strictly related to New Avalon itself. The New Avalon Museum of Art, for instance, had a collection that spanned a good bit of the galaxy and reached back at least a millennium. The one she found most interesting, and most informative as well, was the Wedge Defense Force Museum, which was located on the campus of the WDF Academy, and which she visited on Thursday afternoon. Cora had only a passing interest in military technology or history in themselves, but since the WDF had shaped much of Zaytan culture, and it was Zaytan culture and its attitude toward the present galaxy she was mainly interested in, it was still a valuable experience. In the end, though, the thing she came away thinking the most about wasn't in the museum itself, but in the rotunda of the Academy's administration building, where she'd found herself at the end of the museum's self-guided audio tour. Among the various artworks and whatnot on display here, there was a large bronze plaque affixed to the wall. Upon entering the room, Cora had taken it for the usual kind of thing one found in buildings like this, with the date of the dedication ceremony, and a list of the people who had funded its construction, or the like. But that didn't account for the little crowd of uniformed cadets standing there regarding it with deeply thoughtful expressions. Intrigued, she joined them, working her way to the front as those ahead of her got their fill of contemplating the plaque and drifted away. She noticed that, as each cadet took his, her, or its leave, they all reached and touched the lower left corner. Already, in the 7 years this version of the Academy had been open, this had been done enough that the spot was worn shiny and smooth. Embossed on the plaque in large, authoritative letters were 4 sentences and an attribution. We do not fight because we hate, nor because we wish to control. We do not kill for killing's own sake. We fight because we love, love life, love freedom, love decency. We kill so that others may live, free from oppression, terror, and pain. Miria Felina Sterling, Class of 2001. Cora got out her little notebook and wrote down the message, then put it away and stood regarding the plaque for several minutes. At length, she went away to think it over in solitude, if such a word could be applied to anyone at large in a city like this one. Solitude within her own mind, anyway, as she moved alone among shoals of strangers, brushing gently against the ebb and flow of New Avalon's pleasantly unfamiliar energies. She went back downtown and just walked around for a while as afternoon slid toward evening, mulling the words over in her mind. Later, while waiting for her dinner in a corner booth of a restaurant near her hotel called the Star of Kumbaria, she found herself jotting them repeatedly on another page of her notebook. By the time she noticed consciously that she was doing it, she'd translated the message into Tukisi, then Tongyu, condensing the text slightly and drawing the characters meticulously in different arrangements, as if designing a tattoo. She supposed, as her soup arrived and she put the notebook away, that that was fitting. In 120 years of living, Cora had never felt sufficiently motivated to get any ink done. But if she ever did, it'd have to be something as meaningful as that. And the words of Miria Sterling, whoever she had been, resonated with her more strongly than anything else she had encountered in this city so far. In fact, the more she thought about it as she ate her supper, the more she decided that if she had to summarize her own personal code in a few sentences, she wouldn't be able to do any better than that. That was promising, if it was meant sincerely, and so far she had the distinct impression that it was. Promising enough that she could feel good about devoting the time and energy required to investigate further. After dinner, as she had every evening so far, Cora shook off the dust of academic and Big C cultural pursuits in favor of exploring the more popular side of New Avalon's culture, getting out into the town and seeing what its people were like and what they did for fun. On that particular night, she went to a little theater in Claremont and caught a few promising local rock bands. Other evenings that week found her taking in a karate tournament at a dojo in Elstree, watching a minor league hockey game, checking out open mic night at Coffee Kingdom, and attending Friday night firefight at the Battledrome. On Saturday, she got a slightly later start than usual, then made up for it by spending pretty much the whole day in the press archive room at the Avalon County Public Library. There, with an unlimited all-day pass to the deep stacks, she worked her way through a heap of news articles and feature analysis pieces on the history of the city, starting with its foundation during the reconstruction of the WDF in the 80s and leading up to the extensive recent coverage of the formation of the IPO. What she found was interesting and informative, but having been reprocessed through the city's various press organs, it was also a bit dry and clinical. Returning to her hotel room at 5:30, Cora made herself some tea and considered her next move for a few minutes. She thought she'd absorbed enough freeze-dried information from the press archives for one day. Now she needed something a bit warmer and more immediate. As she had done every evening so far, she needed to get out and move around in the city, see if she could put some living flesh on the skeletal understanding of the place she'd begun to develop. This time, though, she needed to talk to some people. To really interact with them, not just chat in passing or watch them at play, as she had done during the opening phase of the project. It was time to take things up a level. She thought. Saturday night. With a smile, she switched on the data term built into the room's desk and opened the city directory. How many guys could there be in this town named Mike Zandt? 73, as it turned out. She thought again, and started hunting around to see if there was a menu where she could start paring that down. It took a few minutes to dope out, but eventually she discovered that there was, and a short but diverting romp through the demographics of Avalon County left her with two numbers to choose from. She picked the numerically higher one at random, dialed it, and reached her party in two rings. "Hello?" said a familiar voice. "Ha," thought Cora. "Hi, Mike? It's Cora. Cora Mizuzoku from Sipang. We met at the spaceport the other day?" There was a momentary pause, long enough that she thought she might have been mistaken about recognizing his voice, But then Mike replied, hi. Sorry, I wasn't expecting you to call me. What's up? I've got a question for you, Cora said. What's the best night spot in town right now? Well, I'm not an authority by any means, but I'd say it's a tie between three or four places on AQS. Avenue Queen Shiva, the main drag in Salutown, Mike explained, belatedly realizing that someone from out of town couldn't be expected to know the shorthand. For the college crowd, anyway. There's jazz clubs and stuff further downtown, but that's really for the older set. Cora suppressed a giggle and said, Salutown, huh? Yeah, NAU is right on the Salutown-Claremont border. Claremont has the coffee bars and goth places. Salutown has the more mainstream stuff. Listen, he hesitated, then went on. A couple of friends and I were planning to head down there tonight, if you'd like to come check it out. My treat. Kind of a welcome-to-town thing, he added hastily. Not like a date, unless that's what you were looking for, but I didn't want to seem like I was assuming. I mean, 'cause, you know what, I'm just going to stop now. This time Cora couldn't stop herself from giggling. Spirits, she thought. I think I was smoother than that on my first try. Not that it worked. But he didn't take it personally. Yeah, sorry, not so much, she said. I mean, I'm only in town for a few weeks, right? I'm not really looking for that kind of thing. But I'd love to hang out and meet your friends if that's still cool. Oh, absolutely, Mike replied, sounding relieved. No, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's not a problem. Ah, jeez. Relax, Mike, said Cora kindly. Deep breaths. Yeah, sorry. I'm not much good on the phone, he said apologetically. Anyway, meet you in an hour outside the Queen Shiva Square North stop on the N? I promise I'm not as much of a spaz in person. I'll see you there, Cora assured him. Till then. After he rang off, she hung up the phone, thought for a second, then said aloud, Okay. New objective added. Let's try not to break that kid's heart. She went into the bathroom and freshened up a bit, combed her hair and put it back up again, and then went back out to stand by the bed and consider her limited wardrobe. There wasn't a lot of room for clothes in her small bag, after all, and traveling light had seemed like the best idea for this trip. On the plus side, though, the hotel's laundry was very efficient, and everything laid out before her was fresh and crisp. Better laundered than she generally got them herself, come to that. She was many things, but a domestic goddess was not one of them. The problem was, she wasn't sure exactly what people of her apparent age wore to go clubbing in this city, but she was reasonably sure she hadn't packed it, whatever it was. She could just rock up in a t-shirt and jeans and play the from-out-of-town card, but she decided against it. That was a card she didn't much care to play, and besides, she wanted not to be an obvious tourist tonight. Finally, she gave up, conceding to herself that this wasn't something she had enough context to crack on her own, went downstairs to the lobby and asked the desk clerk, So listen, I'm going clubbing in Salutown with some local kids tonight, and I don't really think I packed the right clothes for that. Do you know someplace nearby I can go to fix that? As she had hoped, he was delighted to direct her to just the place, and confident that they would have what she needed. The address he pointed her at was a second-hand shop of the cheerfully eclectic variety, Ditko's Vintage by name, which, Cora was given to understand, drew most of its trade from the nearby university. It was the kind of place that had mannequins which were recognizably humanoid rather than having weird, abstract shapes where their hands and heads belonged, creaky wood floors, and a little bell that rang when she opened the door from the street. The clerk, a raven-haired and unflappable young woman in a green sweater, listened to Cora's plan for the evening, looked her up and down once, and then conjured from the shop's widely varied and weirdly curated stock the perfect outfit. The experience reminded Cora a little bit of shopping at Ming's, except the shop girl here didn't actually dress her. In this context, that would have been a bit weird. It was a bit weird at Ming's, too, come to that, but you learn to accept it as part of what made the place so unique. She glanced at the narrow bangle-style wristwatch that the girl at Ditko's had included as part of the outfit. If the train was on time, and she'd noticed by this point that the trains in New Avalon usually were, she would be too. The clothes she left the shop wearing were a significant departure from her usual plain, practical style, but she looked good, and she knew it, so she didn't feel particularly self-conscious as she caught the N uptown. Just confident. Maybe even a little bit daring, though it wasn't as if she was actually planning to do anything that required intrepidity tonight. She felt good, was what she felt, ready for the kind of night on the town, any town, that she hadn't had in a while, and looking forward to the evening for more than just its informational value. I'll bet you 15 credits she doesn't show up, said the blonde in the red PVC mini-dress. Next to her, a lean, swarthy, black-clad man with an Errol Flynn mustache grinned and said, I'll bet you 20 credits she doesn't even exist. The blonde giggled. Oh, that's cold, Rafik, she said. With an apologetic smile for the well-dressed, rugged youth to her right, she added, I wasn't going to go that far. Hey, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Mike's a liar, Rafik interjected. I just think he was hallucinating. Math all-nighter plus double shift equals space madness, he said, widening his eyes crazily. Mike Zant sighed and rolled his eyes. Yeah, go ahead and laugh. You guys will see, he said in a long, suffering tone. Seriously, dude, Rafik chided him good-naturedly. There are no women who look like that. As he said it, he noticed someone emerging from the Queen Shiva Square North End Station, where Mike had told them their companion for the evening would be joining them. Taking a closer look, he trailed to a halt, then said, Except that one. Seeing the expression on his face, the blonde turned to look, then blinked, her eyes going wide. Oh, my, she said. I know, right? Said Rafik. Mike would have taken the opportunity to gloat a little, except that he was as blown away as his friends. The woman walking toward them from the end station was the one he had met at the spaceport the other day, all right. Same distinctive hairstyle. Same face, same smile. But she was dressed entirely differently, and the effect was just shy of a smack to the forehead. Instead of a snug singlet and a spacer's coverall with the top tied around her waist, she wore a sleek miniskirt and jacket combo, mostly royal blue leather. The skirt had a panel of lighter blue in front, cut to mimic the drape of a jaunty sash, and an angled white stripe just below the waist. The jacket was abbreviated, half-length, with a narrow white shawl collar and sleeves that were really just epaulets with delusions of grandeur, so that, as before, her nicely toned arms were accented. Under it, she wore a tight-fitting bustier of some vertically ribbed light blue fabric, so that her finely honed abs were on display as well, and, given the dark tights and low sporty boots she wore with the skirt, Mike could plainly see that her legs, hidden by that baggy jumpsuit she'd been wearing at the spaceport, lived up to the rest of her. I want that jacket, said Rafik quietly. It wouldn't fit you, the blonde pointed out. I want those shoulders too, Rafik agreed with a nod. Hey, said Cora, grinning, as she came within earshot. Nice to see you again, Mike. Thanks for letting me tag along tonight.
No problem, said Mike, making a concerted effort to reel his tongue back in.
Let me introduce my friends. This is Rafik, he gestured, and Gisela.
Guys, this is Cora.
It's actually pronounced Cora, said Cora. I keep telling the passport office that Macron doesn't really belong there, but, you know, bureaucracy. What are you going to do, right? Nice to meet you.
Gisela looked like she wasn't quite sure what to say, but already Cora had the suspicion that that was rarely a problem for Rafik, who poked one of her leather-clad shoulders with a finger, then grinned and said,
Okay, you do exist.
Turning to Gisela, he added cheerfully, I owe you 20 credits, and you owe Mike 15, or should I just give you 5 and the rest to him, for efficiency's sake?
Beg pardon? Said Cora.
Ignore them, said Mike hastily. You look amazing.
Thank you. I have to give the credit to the girl at Ditko's downtown, though, Cora said. She really fixed me up.
Not all the credit, surely, said Rafik. Some of it has to go to whoever those jeans came from. And your trainer, too, come to that. Just look at those arms. I'm so jealous.
Mike palmed his face.
Rafik, he said.
What?
Rafik said innocently.
Cora laughed.
Down, boys, she said merrily. You'll give me a complex. Besides, you three are looking pretty sharp yourselves. What do you say we get started?